independent media is more important than ever. We don't have a corporate network behind us, and we also don't have big green foundation grants. So we really do need you, and we are actively calling in your direct support so that we can continue exploring many of these topics and perspectives often sidelined by mainstream media. If you're enjoying our show, please make sure you're subscribed and join us on Patreon today, starting at a tip of just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Every little bit helps and really adds up, and that is the power in community. So thank you so much for however you're able to support our work.
And I should say the root of economy is the same as the root of ecology. And it really just means our home. And so it's about the management or care of our home.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Today, we welcome Amanda Janu, an economic policy expert who works with Wellbeing Economy Alliance as their economics and policy lead. Amanda has over a decade of experience working with governments and international development institutions around the world. Her work aims to build just and sustainable economies through goal-oriented and participatory policy design processes.
So the term heterodox encapsulates pretty much anything that's not like neoclassical economics. And so that can be ecological economists, feminist economics, institutional economics. There's many, many others. But I was really starting to study economics right before the financial crisis. And then I think there were already a lot of the writing on the wall that this assumption that the economy is some abstract thing out there that is governed by its own natural laws beyond our control was clearly starting to crumble. And yet there wasn't a clear alternative paradigm by which to sort of replace this. And so I spent a lot of time, I think, also trying to understand history of economic thought. Where did some of these ideas come from in the first place? And I think there's always, when you look at history and the particularly individuals who came up with these ideas, it makes a lot more sense. So, you know, coming out of the Industrial Revolution, a lot of the sort of neoclassical ideas emerge from this desire for individual freedom and liberty from more feudalistic control. But the pendulum swung so far that now all we think about is the individual. And if the individual in terms of their material accumulation as being the ultimate metric of our success. But I think that that loses so many of the fundamental things that ultimately bind us as humans and being in right relationship with one another and our natural environment. And so that was sort of part of this journey through heterodox economics. But I was always a lot more interested in less of the theory and more of how do you actually practically change it, which was what led me to, policy movement building in the economic systems change sphere.
You mentioned metrics. I mean, one of the major frustrations and issues I have with mainstream economics is how they seem to center GDP as the most important measurement to determine how well a nation is doing. And if we're measuring the wrong things to begin with and trying to gauge people's quality of life, then the political decisions that follow will also fail or fall short of any intentions or surface level intentions to actually improve people's livelihoods. And we know, for example, that the GDP goes up after oil spills, and that even as GDP increases, wealth disparity and the nuances of chronic disease and anxiety and depression levels all have continued to grow. And I know that there are always going to be limitations in terms of what we try to measure, because not everything that is vital to our health and quality of life is quantifiable. But if we wanted to take a more accurate pulse on the state of the world in terms of health and happiness and community relations and move towards systems that center the health of people and our planet, what are some numbers we already have that you've been keen to look at in this economic reorientation? And what do they reveal to us about where we're currently at and where we're headed?
Beautifully summarized. So at this point, I would say particularly within the well-being economy movement or alliance, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of sort of alternative GDP indicators, dashboards, indexes, and they vary in different sort of forms. And they tell different stories. So for example, there's the Happy Planet Index, which really just tells you how much happiness per unit material consumption is generated. And that sort of flips some of this development paradigm on its head, for example, where the kind of communities that and countries that end up ranking highest are not countries like the United States, but countries like Costa Rica, where you have much higher levels of happiness and equity and prosperity with less material consumption. I would say that an important part looking at the practical development is less of the indicators themselves as the process for their development. So the countries that have gone through some sort of participatory process of actually asking their citizens and communities, what kind of society do you want to leave for your children and grandchildren? Or what do you think really matters for well-being now and for generations to come? Being able to articulate that vision clearly in the kind of language that resonates with a particular culture and place, and then work to identify indicators, which can help you to set clear targets in those domains and also then monitor progress. And I think one of the challenges we see right now is that I would say across the board, some of the common areas that are looked at are obviously health, education, social connection, time, clean air, clean water, biodiversity, etc. And then issues of equity, of what is the distribution of these important aspects of well-being amongst different demographic groups or areas. And part of the challenge is that we kind of are still throwing together social, environmental, and economic indicators all together. And they're not really commensurate because the economy is just part of our society within a larger ecosystem. And so this is something that for myself, I still grapple with as well, that even what is the interaction between the social and the environmental indicators? Should we just be prioritizing the environmental ones with the assumption that then that will always be beneficial to humanity, which is just a part of this larger ecosystem? And what is that sort of interrelationship between them? But I think the most important thing we can do is to downgrade the economy and recognize that it's a means, not an ends, and to really think about what aspects of the way that we produce and provide for one another we want to encourage and the kinds that we want to discourage in order to support our collective well-being.
Yeah, I appreciate the emphasis on understanding and seeing the economy as a means to the end and not as the thing to prioritize at all costs. And again, also taking into account different metrics that there are out there. Your work centers on what's called the well-being economy. And I'm aware of various alternative economic models that people have proposed, like degrowth economics, donut economics, circular economy, regenerative economy, and so forth. Can you introduce this well-being economy to people who may not have heard of it before and share about how it relates to some of the other alternative models out there that also attempt to address the shortcomings of our current capitalistic systems?
Yeah, so the Well-Being Economy Alliance, at least, was really emerged a few years after the financial crisis, so about 5-6 years ago. And we say that it has many mothers. And so it was a coming together of a lot of quote-unquote heterodox economic thinkers who represented a lot of the different types of concepts that you just mentioned in terms of ecological economists, post-growth, donut economics, circular economy, etc., who felt that what was needed was less of conceptual theorizing about the economy and what was needed was more movement building. So how could we act as a picnic blanket that could amplify a wide range of these different concepts and initiatives and invite in a wider range of actors who come from, let's say, environmental activism or public health, mental health, racial equity, or many more, who recognize that we're just dealing with symptoms and we need to move upstream and redesign the economy so that it's evaluated by its contribution to people and planet's well-being. And so part of the challenge is that it was always meant to be a pluralist concept that could hold a wide range of different theories, models, initiatives. And part of the challenge is that now that the well-being economy is being adopted, I think, by more and more governments, organizations, movements, there's a need for greater conceptual clarity in order to ensure that it's not ultimately greenwashed or co-opted to mean nothing. But also, the more that you define something in strict forms, the more that you're ultimately going to lose the capacity for it to be contextual and also to be open to such a wide range of different thoughts and initiatives. So it's ultimately a movement building concept. But yeah, we're probably like all are still learning and evolving as times change and we see different types of challenges emerge.
Yeah, I really resonate with this sort of both and of wanting to define something so they don't give room to be able to be co-opted, but also recognizing that a lot of things are place-based and need to honor the context of different communities and bio-cultural regions and so forth. You've talked about this challenge that when we talk about the economy, a lot of people feel powerless, whether due to the ways that corporations seem to have a stranglehold on many government interests or because the concept of the economy can feel out of reach from what an individual or a household can influence. But as you emphasize, I want to remind everyone that we are the economy, end quote. I would appreciate it if you can speak more to the sentiment of powerlessness or disconnection that many of us feel in the context of our economy and perhaps more foundational ways that we might understand what the economy even is in order to be able to better relate to it.
The economy, the way that I describe it, is it's the way that we produce and provide for one another. It's an aspect of life on this planet, and it's always about the ways in which we interact with one another and our natural environment to improve our collective quality of life. And I do feel, and I very much can understand why people feel a lot of powerlessness over this concept, because even on our mainstream media, we hear every single day this term economy constantly, and it seems to be presented as the most important thing that will trump any other consideration. But at the same time, the one area that's too complicated for us to understand or beyond the scope of our immediate influence. And so often when we speak about the economy, it comes alongside discussions of GDP growth rates or stock market values and maybe discussions of mergers and acquisitions, employment numbers, but it makes it feel like it's a domain purely governed by business and finance. But there's a brilliant woman, Neva Goodwin, who really articulates that the economy actually has three different domains. And there is the business and finance realm, which is really governed by profit motive and competitiveness. But then you have also the public purpose realm. And those are the kind of institutions like government, academia, nonprofits, et cetera, that are producing and providing things with a public purpose in mind, a public orientation. And then you have the care, the core economy, which are the ways in which we provide for one another as friends, families, neighbors, out of a motivation of care and reciprocity. And I think it's important to remember that all of those are part of the economy. And to be able to shine light on the important value that's particularly, I think, hidden when we think about the care economy and how vital that is for our sense of meaning and connection, purpose, and belonging as well.
And so if the economy is how we provide for one another, then really economies have existed ever since relationships existed and communities existed, right? So maybe the core message here is that it's vital to reclaim and relearn what economies even mean beyond this sort of big the economy that a lot of people might find very daunting to think through.
So I worked in international development for quite a long time prior to joining the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. And I think one of the major issues with economics is this one-size-fits-all economic logic. And that is so embedded with, I think, colonialism and a particular evolution of like Anglo-Saxon philosophical thought of this assumption that across all space and time, people are going to produce and provide for one another the same way, when obviously that's going to be influenced by our history and our culture, our geographies, our policies, and so many other aspects. And so it's important to allow for space for that contextualization and to not feel like we need to wait for some alternative economic system or model to be imposed upon us. And we can feel like we have the capacity to build that better system that we envision and to have the power to do that. Now, obviously, I think you were, you know, mentioning this as well. The issue is just that the level of concentration and power that has occurred makes it really difficult to feel like an individual has the space and the voice to be actively shape their economic realities where they live when you have multinational corporations, which are controlling so much of our sectors, of our supply chains, et cetera, and governments, which are seemingly just beholden to those private interests as well. But I think at the end of the day, what we're seeing is a beautiful renaissance in democracy. At the same time, we're seeing serious threats to democracy as well. And again, everything is always in balance in some way with those kind of dualities that present themselves. But this rise of citizens' assemblies in areas like biodiversity or climate, I see as really exciting innovations where when you ask people, normal people, what kind of transformations they think are needed for environmental goals or social goals, they intuitively understand the kind of transformations that are needed within the economic system in order to achieve those. And so I think it's about trusting and really honoring the importance of lived experience and working collectively to advocate for the space for that to be the driving force in our economic policy moving forward.
And also, if the economy is how we provide for one another, then I don't know if you've thought through this before, but I wonder if the concept of an economy exists in the more than human world as well. And if so, what might we be able to learn from the economy of the more than human world and how we're also a part of that broader economy, which extends beyond human constructs?
Absolutely. And I should say the root of economy is the same as the root of ecology. And it really just means our home. And so it's about the management or care of our home. And I do think about this a lot. It's something I've been wrestling with myself. Friend Evan Steiner mentioned recently a quote about how the fundamental ideology of modernity is a belief that all of our problems can be solved by humans. Yeah. And I think about this a lot, like the arrogance by which we have to think that we're going to be the ones who ultimately have the best knowledge and guidance. And I think about this also in terms of gift economies, how deeply wired we are as humans to give and how it reinforces social trust when we do that and the intrinsic value of the gift when we give to others. That you can't really put a price on it. And the rest of life, I think, it gives so generously and also with such incredible balance that I think a big part of the paradigm shift is, as you're saying, to look at the ways in which all species are providing for one another in a balanced system and to learn and hold them community, I think, as well around, I think part of it is to accept cycles of growth and death as well. Kate Raworth made this point at the Beyond Growth conference last year in Europe, that some of our growth and obsession might be because we're so afraid of our own mortality. And therefore, we have a hard time accepting that everything has a period of growth and then also a period of decline. And to be able to hold that wisdom and know when things need to also be hospiced and to decline in order to allow for that balance.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, an alternative podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show and listen to our disruption-free, extended, and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. I've also thought about this idea of growth and how a lot of times growth in the ways that the mainstream culture defines it is kind of an illusion, because if we're talking about growth in a material sense, which is what GDP often focuses on, there's finite matter as a part of Earth, and therefore all that is possible is constant rearrangements and reconfigurations of where things are. So the growth of something, it has to grow off of something. And so that's important to consider. And so I think about how this idea of reorienting growth means reorienting growth towards what actually can be grown. So that could be intimacy in relationships, diversity, complexity in a system, fulfillment and meaning in how people live their lives. So yeah, even like the verbiage of how we talk about growth and endless growth. And I think about how that's just literally not possible given biology and physics and how this world works in reality.
Absolutely. Actually, I was speaking with a friend, Elizabeth, about yesterday, and it's, you know, inherent within our discussions of the economy is this idea of scarcity. And so I've also been sitting and reflecting with that, because a lot of the environmental articulation, which is important, is to speak to the planetary boundaries and the fact that there are inherent limits to how much you can take from the earth or pollute the earth within the biophysical realities. But then when I was engaging with New Zealand, the Maori developed a well-being framework, and it looks similar to Kate Raworth's donut, except for the difference is that instead of the earth being the boundary, it's the center and the source of all life. And so that's also something I'm sitting with a lot as well, is like, what is our understanding of scarcity versus abundance, and how do we do that in a way that also isn't ultimately disregarding of the realities? I mean, in the end, your point is if energy can never be created or destroyed, it's just transformed. But the thing that freaks me out the most personally probably is biodiversity loss, because once something goes extinct within the time scale of, you know, history or millennia, we will come back into balance. But the loss of an entire species, I think, is something that we need to really grieve and to ensure that we're not doing, because there's real profound implications for that ethically and sustainably.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I very much think that in situating and focusing growth on what can't really be grown, we've actually been heading down this trend of simplification, biodiversity loss, you know, decline in people's senses of connectedness and fulfillment and so forth. So instead of growing this thing that supposedly represents what we want to grow, why don't we just, you know, really focus on what we do want to grow, which is health and happiness and intimacy, diversity, which is foundational to abundance as well, and life on and as Earth. So yeah, this is super fascinating to think about. A central part of your work has been to support participatory democracy, really putting power back into the hands of people and increasing engagement. I feel deeply aligned with this. And also something that I've been thinking about is this question of, you know, what if an entire population of people have already been so indoctrinated to hold certain values, for example, of materialism or hyper-individualism or extractivism, that we might still democratically vote our ways to self and ecological destruction? Like, what if people democratically vote to scale up things like lithium mining in order to support this quote-unquote green energy transition, and this comes at the devastation of indigenous lands stewarded by a minority, and therefore still perpetuating injustice in a democratic way? So I think the question I'm sitting with here also has to do with like how education and media and cultural narratives and values influence our own values and politics and worldviews, which then would also impact the ways that participatory democracy plays out. Just curious what comes to your mind here.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the whole question, Kamea. Like, I think on one hand, this concern is part of the major thing that has always been thrown against democracy, is the belief that people don't know what's good for them, so it's better to have other people make those decisions for them. I think that requires a little bit of faith in people. So we did a pilot in Scotland, and we actually asked children to articulate what they felt was most important for the well-being of their community. And it was really interesting because they got it. They got the, what they needed was closer access to goods and services. They needed more social connection and trust. They needed more time for play for both adults and children together. They saw these larger systemic things, and they were able to come up with some specific initiatives like having a Christmas festival that winter, because they felt like that would help all of those different domains, which makes so much sense. But even within that example, the environmental dimensions were missing, because we're also talking about an urban landscape, right? Where they would probably wouldn't even know that that might be an option. And so this is something, it's kind of a fable, but I think it's real. It was told by one of my development. It was about this NGO that went to a small island in Indonesia and were bringing them cows to help with nutrition and, you know, different sort of issues. And so they brought the cows, and then they came back a few months later, and the community had killed all of the cows except for one, because they didn't have any infrastructure to deal with these cows. And they were just, you know, running around and destroying all of their like gardens and houses, etc. And so the NGO was like, oh, I'm so sorry about that. You go back and you decide what you really want to do and how we can help you. And, you know, we'll make sure that this is actually really led by you. And so the community goes back and they deliberate and come back to the NGO, and they're like, okay, great. How can we help? And they're like, we want cows. And it was because it's the only thing they'd ever been offered. It was the only thing they could think of asking for, right? And so that's always the complexity, I think, when we think about participatory process, because our own imaginations are inherently going to be limited. And so I think that's part of what I like about the citizen assembly model, is that it's a balance between deliberative democratic process, and when there becomes moments where people recognize they need more information, they can bring in experts and relevant resources or tools or materials, facts, etc., that can help guide that. Now, obviously, there's no such thing as unbiased information, so it's always going to probably lead people one way or the other. But I still think if we feel ownership and accountability to this, whatever it is that we articulate we want to do, I think we're in a better position than we are now of feeling like we're beholden to some large corporate or governmental institution making those decisions for us.
Right. So the relationship between participatory democracy and other aspects of society also becoming more democratized, like media not being controlled by a few major corporations, or the education system also not really propping up like one way of knowing per se, or universalized knowledge, but also honoring the diverse ways of knowledge in more democratic ways. Like, democracy needs to kind of be at the core of everything beyond the act of politics itself. Cause yeah, everything kind of feeds into one another. And it's also clear to me that a lot of the ways that our dominant political and economic systems function need to be revamped based on where they are currently today. And sometimes even attempts to incrementally improve something has ended up reinforcing pre-existing dynamics and only superficially creating illusions of change. But with this said, being able to deeply transform society takes time and requires spilling over beyond certain thresholds as well. And I'm still pondering the how, which I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on in a moment as well. But I know that in working in the policy realm, you've gotten to follow and support various things that have worked. And I would love for you to expand more on some of the things that are more within our reach, given our existing reality and systems today, things that have worked in terms of either stalling destructive decisions about to happen or otherwise actually helping to reorient our economies in deeper ways towards more life-affirming values. And I think when we talk about economic transformations, it involves both ways that we can support shorter-term incrementalist changes given the existing systems that a lot of us seem to be or feel locked into right now, And it also involves kind of a complete reorientation of our systemic and cultural values and the ways that things work. So I know this is a big question, but I'd be interested in what you've thought through in regards to how you see this collective composting and reorientation taking place, given that these changes can kind of only occur at the expense and at the surrender of power of those who currently benefit the most from the present systems of uneven accumulation and control, meaning that they're not going to probably willingly give away power and give way for this transition to take place. So how have you envisioned us being able to start collaborating across radical difference to bring the well-being economy to fruition? And yeah, how might this play out, or how has it already started to play out even?
Well, there's a lot of big questions that are sort of embedded in there. I'll maybe speak a little bit to the power question and then to the one around the collaboration. So because I lived internationally for so long, coming back to the United States, I recognize that this is a country of immense power. And so within the global, you know, perspective, we are the problem, right? Like, we are the power that needs to change. I think that even within this epicenter, people are yearning for that change. And I think they see the need for that transformation. So I don't think that it's true to say that just because somebody has privilege or power that they will inherently be against the transformation, because things like the epidemic of loneliness, the ways in which this increasing commodification of our lives and the transactional nature of our relationships is making us miserable. Yeah. So I think that there's even, I mean, I don't know, I'm not rich, right? But I would assume that even rich people are feeling this. And so I think there's something that we can speak to and that can compel a wide range of people across these systems to recognize the need for change. But with that, you know, I do believe in the importance of power in numbers, the power of movements and of people, as you say, coming together across radical difference in solidarity and towards a shared vision of a better world and a better future. And so much of the work that I do at We All is trying to connect different types of initiatives and actors, to be a little bit of people between different layers and players, etc. And it's tough. And particularly, you know, in more individualistic cultures, it's challenging. And one of the things I was just hosting an event in DC where we brought together a variety of state level coalitions that are advancing economic systems change, but under different banners. Some are just transition, solidarity economy, like indigenous, like conceptions, well-being economy, et cetera. And one of the things I realized that we speak a lot about the importance of trust. And I think sometimes we think that trust, or we speak of trust as something that is earned, but in reality, it's like our willingness to make ourselves vulnerable and to open ourselves up for the need of support. But one of the quickest ways to get somebody to trust you is to actually ask them for a favor, which seems so counterintuitive in our contemporary culture, but it's because we're hardwired to give. And when we give to something to somebody else, as small as like a pen or a gift or whatnot, it actually reinforces social trust and it boosts our immune systems, it reduces our stress levels. And so this action of building trust, I think, is at the core of any of this collaboration. And I think it requires the courage of vulnerability for all of us, and the humility to say that we don't know and we make mistakes and we need help if we're going to do that, because I think that's ultimately maybe the recipe for any of that meaningful collaboration moving forward.
I think part of my cynicism definitely comes from just seeing corporate stranglehold on politics and corrupted politicians, and corporations also kind of treated as having personhood, imposing their own extractivist logics into decision-making processes. But it's very true that at the human level, I mean, part of the work is shifting and reorienting our cultural values and returning to what really matters most for our senses of belonging and humanity and interdependence and vitality and so forth. So yeah, thank you for these offerings. As we wrap up our discussion here, what else do you feel called to add that I didn't get to ask you about? And what are some of your calls to action or deeper inquiry for our listeners?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about this right now, but do you know where the corporate personhood came from?
No.
In the US? Okay, so interesting fact. So this was part of the 13th Amendment. So after the Emancipation Proclamation and when we provided like African Americans with 3/4 personhood, corporations lobbied and said, well, if these things are going to be viewed as people, then we should be viewed as people as well. And at the time, it was a persuasive enough argument that it's actually an amendment in our Constitution that was based in a fundamentally racist argument and logic. And so there's a really great quote by Abraham Lincoln, which says something around the lines of, you know, we've allowed for corporate ascendancy in an age of corruption is to follow. Right. And so I think, again, it's like important to understand the context within which these things happen, and it's not inevitable. And of course, corporations are not people, and that 100% needs to be transformed in terms of the ways in which we don't even hold them accountable the way we hold people accountable, but they should be held to much higher account. And so, I mean, I share your cynicism and I hear you in all of that. And I think we're at a really unique moment. I think one of the most probably inspiring books that I've read or that informed me was this book called The Great Transformation by Carl Polanyi. And it's kind of dense, but he talks a lot about how the creation of like laissez-faire capitalism or free market sort of economies was fundamentally a cultural project that required the false commodification of people and nature and money. And that there's only so long you can treat people like commodities before they're going to rebel. And he called it the double movement. And he was writing in the interwar period, and he saw this double movement manifesting in the form of fascism and communism. And I think we're in a moment where we're also in a similar double movement where it's not just people anymore, it's nature too. The camp can no longer be treated like a commodity. And I think we're seeing that counter narrative of fascism very clearly emerging in response. And I think what is needed, and what I hope the well-being economy and degrowth and regenerative economy and many others can coalesce to offer an alternative, hopeful vision of political systems which are more democratic, of societies which are more connected and of a natural environment, and all species that are treated with dignity and respect. And so, yeah, I think if there's any sort of call to action, maybe I'll just reiterate what you said earlier. It's just a reminder that we are the economy. And if anybody's really interested and passionate about connecting with others working to advance economic systems change, we would love to have you join the We All family. You can check us out at weall.org.
Well, Green Dreamer, we are coming to a close here, but we will have more references and resources from this episode linked in our show notes at greendreamer.com. And for now, Amanda, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. We covered so much and just so grateful for this conversation. What final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers as we close off?
I guess it's just to remember that system change is a marathon, not a sprint. And so it's important that you, take time for yourself, enjoy the process, and stick with it.
Green Dreamer is a community-powered podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our work and tune into our extended and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Our production manager and researcher is Anissa Simohali. Our writer and audio editor is Yasmin Danoon. And I'm your host and producer, Kamea Shane. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you soon in our next episode.